Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Contract Revolution. This is Benji. Look, we spend a ton of time on this show on systems, best practices, and tactics, but today's conversation is a human one. Our very own Breakthrough Academy member, Brady Williams of Oxglass, went through one of the most terrifying and harrowing experiences you will ever hear. Back on June 8th, 2023, while Brady was thousands of miles away at a business retreat, his son James, back home in Utah, fell backward off a third-story balcony straight onto his head. He shattered his skull, he punctured his lung, and damaged a bunch of other vital organs as well. He was given minimal chances of survival, and even if that did happen, a normal life was completely off the table. So if you want systems or tactics, come back next week. Today's conversation is all about James's miraculous battle for survival, Brady's experience as a father, and how the Oxglass team rallied around to support a family in their time of need. Without further ado, let's dive in with Brady.
You're listening to Contractor Evolution, where we unpack the systems, tactics, and skills you need to take your fast-growing contracting business to the next level.
If you're here to learn what it takes to scale up, work less, and increase profitability, you've come to the right place.
Stay tuned to learn what separates the new breed of contractor from the old school, and welcome to your ultimate guide on the business of contracting.
Brady Williams, it's so good to see you, man. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Okay, we got to talk wardrobe here right at the beginning. I'm going to tell you a little story about Elmer Glick, and then I want your thoughts. Maybe you can give him some advice. So, Elmer Glick, Starway Roof Systems, they specialize in residential roofing. They've been a member since 2023, a Breakthrough Academy member since 2023. They work with the rock star head coach, Harold Frederick, those are his words, located in State College, Pennsylvania. So I asked him just for a win and a challenge, and this is what I want maybe some advice from you on. One big challenge we are working on this year is letting go of the reins and allowing our people to do the job we hired them to do. Learning to trust people has been a mindset shift that we have been learning since being in Breakthrough Academy. Mike Michalowicz at this year's Winter Summit said, "A business is not a business for the owner to do the work, but to provide opportunities for the people within the company. I love that so much, and it challenged me to take it to heart and really work towards removing myself from the day-to-day. We're in growth mode, though, so some days things seem chaotic with new hires, new processes, etc. Everything's a challenge. Few wins we have. We grew 80% last year. That's huge. Shout out to you, Elmer. And maintained a healthy 20% net profit. That's even better. And are targeting 100% growth in 2025 as well. Pricing correctly is one of the biggest needle movers that we found to help us solve most of our issues that come up. It's true. Money solves a lot of problems. We also rebranded, which has been awesome, and it allows us to do a lot of things with the mascot logo instead of the traditional roof over initials, which is what we had before. It's a very classic roofer logo. Roof, and then it says ABC or BTA or whatever. Very boring. This is way better. Well done, Elmer. Any advice for Elmer on his journey? You heard a few data points there. Brady, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, for sure. Get yourself out of the way. If you're still in all the day-to-day and micromanaging, you know, you just got a glorified job. You don't really have a business. And so for sure, get yourself out of the way and you're going to have a lot of success.
Okay, let's dive into this story. This is a very human, a very personal, and a really, frankly, wild story that we're going to tell. And that's why we're having Brady on today is to talk about it and talk about some of the lessons therein. I'm going to set this up and then I'm going to hand you the mic. For our Breakthrough Academy members listening, this all starts at Leadership Retreat back in June of 2023. For our non-Breakthrough Academy listeners, Leadership Retreat is one of a few Breakthrough Academy members events that we host in person. And this one happened to take place at a really nice fishing lodge in Ontario, Canada. We had about, I think, 80 people all together. We facilitated some workshops. We did a fishing derby. We eat great food, have some beers, have some laughs, connect. It's a really, really, really fun and meaningful event for all that come. Now, this one was a little different. I woke up on the second morning, came into breakfast, and I looked at our mutual friend, Brady Dan Stav, who you work with. And Coach Dan Stav coaches the Master Circle group, which is our high performance invite only group at Breakthrough Academy, which Brady's a part of. And Dan looks at me, gaunt in the face, looked like he'd seen a ghost. And he just says, Benji, I got to talk to you about something. Brady's gone. So I'm going to just leave it there and allow you to pick up the story from there, Brady.
Okay. So something else that's really relevant to this story is where the lodge was located.
Oh,
it was
okay.
Out on an island in the middle of a lake. What was the lake called? It was a blur.
Yeah. Oh, I think it was Lake of the Woods. Yeah. We're on Lake of the Woods. It was super remote.
Yeah. So like we were, it was like almost a 2-hour boat ride out to the island. There's no cell service. There's no internet. By design,
yeah,
to get us all to just focus on the weekend and what we were going to learn. And so, you know, I travel out there and fly into Winnipeg and then take the bus ride out to the little town. We get on the transportation. We go up this lake on a boat, all of us, 2 hours to this island. Check in. It's really cool. It's beautiful. And just retire for the night. And I don't have... Just true to what we were warned, there's no service, yeah. There's no data, there's no email, nothing. And knock off early, go to bed, and little to know what I'd wake up to. And I'm a real early riser, and so I get up at my usual 3:30 in the morning, and my phone is glowing, like it's got a ping. I was like, well, we don't have any service out here. And there was I just look at my phone and there's a notification from my billing email and saying urgent. So I, what the, and I look at it and it's a notice from my son who runs my accounting department saying James is in the hospital. Call as soon as you can. And this is 3:30 in the morning, so it's 2:30 Utah time. And so in the hospital, and I open the email, and it just says, James has fallen, a major accident, call home as soon as you can. So I get up, and I throw some shorts on, and I run out barefoot and bare-chested, and trying to get a signal. I was like, man, I don't know how I got a signal, but somehow I got a signal. So I go running along the lakeside in the dark at 3:30, 4 in the morning now, trying to get any kind of a signal to see what's going on. Now, I should prompt. James is, let me keep going for a minute and make more sense. So I'm running along the shore for probably a quarter mile, and I finally get a bar just out along the shore. And I text my wife and a couple texts come through, and it's my wife, Rosemary. And she says, James has fallen. He's had a major accident, trauma to the head. He's in brain surgery right now, trying to save him. And then I try to call and she picks up and I get a garbled 2 or 3 words from her. And so I just text a few more. And then she says, please come home as soon as you can. I'll let you know when he gets out. Mm-hmm. But I need to go. So all I know is my son James has had a major catastrophic accident and he's in brain surgery. And so I run back to the lodge and nobody's awake. Everybody's asleep. And I'm beside myself. I don't know what to do with myself. And so I'm pacing around. My mind's going a million miles an hour, trying to figure out how in the hell am I going to get off this island? You know, I had irrational thoughts like I'm just going to jump in one of these boats and, you know, hot rod it and try to get back. But then I was like, no, I'll get lost. This isn't good. And then I noticed a light coming from the kitchen, and one of the staff had gotten up early to prep for breakfast for all these people. So I go in there. And I said, I need to talk to someone, and I need to be able to get off this island. I've had a major accident. Well, he goes and gets the camp director.
Whatever, steward, yeah. Yeah.
Who has a sat phone. And she starts mobilizing people. And then right about that time, Dan Dasko, which was one of the coaches for BTA, really, really good, high-quality individual, as you know, had gotten up and was going swimming. An early, early morning.
Another
swim.
Early riser. Yeah.
And he's another real early riser. We both like cold plunging and stuff like that. And so he sees me pacing around the outside of this lodge trying to figure out. I had no idea where anybody from BTA, which rooms they were in, what lodge they were in.
We'd just gotten there 12 hours before. Literally, it just arrived, set our bags down. It's a nice fishing lodge set in the woods on a remote island, 2 hours from a four-hour bus ride to a small airport in Canada. I mean, we are in the sticks, man. I don't blame you for being a little lost.
And I'm trying to get home because my sons could be dying or dead. And Dasko says, you sit down. And then he got Paul Atherton, who came, and then everybody mobilized. And they got Dan Stav, Coach Stav, and him and Dasko and James Dale sat with me while they started calling everybody. And they got on a sat phone or something like that and were able to get a hold of my my main guy, Josh, and my son, Lake, and start figuring out how to get me out. And all of the transport boats were gone. So all we had were the fishing boats. And then they kind of held vigil with me for about 45 minutes while they made plans on how to get me back to the village and get me some plane tickets and things like that. So long story short, it was like a 2-hour boat ride out. Kudos to whoever that fishing guide was that put me in his little fishing boat with Dan Stav. And we made a 2-hour boat ride into like an hour boat ride. I mean, it was like a ski boat now, not a fishing boat. We were just across those waves and we made it back to the little town on the lake. And it just so happened that there was a big countertop, one-ton countertop truck that one of the BTA people had driven from Vancouver all the way to Winnipeg or to that little town waiting. And he threw the keys at Stav and says, just take my truck, do what you need. And so we were really fortuitous that there was a truck there. And then Stav took a 3.5-hour drive and turned it into a 2-hour drive.
He was with you. Dan was with you. That whole drive
Dan
back?
Dan drove me.
Got it.
Because he says, listen, there's no way I'm going to have you drive in your mental state. And that's a good thing, you know. And so he got me to the airport on time. Well, by the time I got to off the lake, we had cell service again. So I'm having lengthy discussions with Rosemary, James. And this is what happened to James. Well, maybe I'll get into the details of what happened later after I tell you how I get there, but. So he drives me to the airport. My son got me plane tickets as quick as he could. Kudos to Delta Airlines. Like, I will forever be a customer. They bent over backwards to get me on the soonest flight they could. They asked a first class ticket holder if he would mind moving back, and they put me in the 1A first class seat so I could get off the plane as quick as possible. I ran through customs. We had two backup sets of plane tickets in case I missed the one flight out of Minneapolis. And Delta actually held the door. So, because they knew I was incoming and it would be just minutes to get through security and customs. And Delta held the door, and I just ran through security and customs to get my connecting flight and right onto the plane, and they shut the door and took off. And then I landed in Salt Lake 5:30 that same night. Well, 5, and then I was bedside by 5:30. Mm-hmm. So what happened is James was at his sister's house. Now, James is my oldest son from my wife, Rosemary, and he he was like a barefoot trail runner. He was 185 pounds, a gorilla. Mm. I mean, the guy was just a beast, physical specimen. Never smoked, you know, ate healthy food. He just did everything. And he also was a foreman of one of my top crews and a real quality individual. He was a leader within the family. I have a huge family, and he was a leader within that family to all of his siblings, and was just this amazing figure in my life. And he was over at his sister's that night, and she's in a third story townhome. And him and his girlfriend were over there with his sister and her boyfriend, and they were just visiting and dancing, having a good time visiting. And he's always been a risk taker and a yahoo. And he's out on her balcony, and he decides to tease his sister like he always does. And he's a daredevil construction worker guy, and he's sitting on the rail, pretending like this is as his sister told me, pretending like he's, whoa, look at me, I'm going to fall, teasing her. And then he does. And he falls 30 feet onto his head on the sidewalk below.
He's on the railing, kind of looking into the patio, and he falls backwards over the rail.
Yeah, he's sitting kind of side skewed, side saddle on the rail and teasing his sister just like, whoa, you know. And then lost his balance and flipped over and landed head first.
Third story onto his head.
Yeah. And he went and turned and then landed, and he landed on his, on the left side of his head and the back side of his shoulder. And so what it did was a catastrophic, damage to his skull and brain. It tore his pelvis away from his spine and fractured the pelvis in half, essentially split it. He broke 4 vertebrae in his lower back and 3 ribs, which punctured his liver and his lung. He fractured all of his skull around his sinuses, and then the fracture, he crushed this, and then it fractured all the way up and over to the front. And so fortuitously, it was in Murray, Utah, and Murray has a top 10 trauma unit in the United States. And he was 5 minutes away from that hospital. The paramedics were there within 6 minutes of the accident. They happened to be right there in the neighborhood. They had him to the hospital within 15 minutes. And then a top 10 neurosurgeon in the nation happened to be on call that night, and he was in surgery within an hour.
Wow.
To make sure that the brain swelling couldn't advance, right? And so they immediately got him in and removed half of his skull so that the pressure, you know, from the trauma
is away from his brain.
Yeah, so that the brain could swell and not be constricted by that. That's what would kill you, right? So they immediately removed half of his skull.
Do you know what you were obviously, you were still asleep in bed when this actual event, fall happened, trip to the hospital, top 10 neurosurgeon gets called in. Have you learned in the post-mortem at that moment I know this is graphic, but like what the percentage chance of survival was at that stage this is a heavy duty injury. This is not a broken arm. This isn't even a broken femur. This is broken everything, and the brain's the worst part. So is this like a 10% chance of survival, 25? Like,
they
did
were
you ever
shocked
get that data point?
Even in the hospital alive, number one, the neurosurgeon just said, first of all, the only reason your son's alive is literally how much muscle mass he has on him.
Because he was beefy and fit and vital and just like a solid, solid unit. Okay.
Very strong, layered individual, super, super healthy. His system, you know, he was able to resist the initial impact is what saved his life, was just how fit he was. And then it also went on to prove for the long run, which we're about to go into. Because, I mean, as horrific as this sounds, it gets way worse.
Yeah.
And he, yeah, he shouldn't have lived. And then that night I get there and they come in and they consult with me and they're just like, okay, this is where your son's at over the next 24 hours. If he can stabilize, you know, he's going to have all of these, you know, tremors and fevers and all of these things from the impact of just the brain. We're not even worrying about his liver or his lung or his back or his hip. None of that. We're just trying to make it so that his brain will keep telling his heart to beat. Mm-hmm. And his lungs to breathe.
Right.
And so, you know, he's intubated and they have him on a respirator and to keep him breathing. Right. And,
so take us through the prognosis from there and how things progress. That's the impact. That's what happened. And then, but there's the days and the weeks, and I think even the months that followed. We in the BTA universe had a Slack channel dedicated. There was a GoFund. I mean, we're all kind of like keeping tabs, you know, via Dan Stav, who's in touch with you on a weekly basis. But this is actually the first chance I've had to hear about the moment to moment story from there. So what happened after that night?
Yeah. So 3 days later, he's stabilizing, but now he's starting to destat on his oxygen.
What does that mean?
And so his oxygen levels are going way down. He's not able to bring on enough oxygen or offload CO2. And it's getting scarier and scarier. So they're starting to do MRIs and CT scans and x-rays of his lungs, and they're filling up. And then everything starts cascading really fast on the third day, and he's gone into septic shock. So now his lungs are filling up, and he can't breathe anymore. And so on the third day, me and Rose are standing vigil by his bedside when everything just starts going off. Every alarm bell starts going off. And essentially, my son died. And sorry. Some of this will get pretty emotional, but everybody runs into the room and they start bagging him and trying to save him. And there's a nurse up on top of his bed with a bag forcing his lungs to open. And 10 minutes later, a social worker comes in and, you know, we see him flatline. And so they do the EpiPen into the heart to get his heart to start beating again. And, they pull us out. The social worker's standing by us because, you know, he's not going to make it. And then miraculously, he pulls through. His heart starts going again, but the nurse is still bagging him. And then they're congregating all the neurosurgeons and now a trauma unit for the thoracic. And they're saying, this is the problem. Your son, all of your son's organs are shutting down. He's full of infection. His whole body has gone septic and his lungs don't work. And here's your choice. We can let him go and he'll die within the next 5-10 minutes. Or we can do what is not even available to us, which is put him on ECMO, which is where they take all of his blood out of his jugular vein, run it through an ECMO machine to oxygenate it and to offload CO2 and then back up through his groin. But that procedure, he's not a candidate because has a major brain trauma and that pressurizes the system.
Right.
And it'll cause more brain bleed.
Right.
And they said, so we can do this. Most likely he'll die on the
operating table. But it's a Hail Mary. Like they're super.
It's a total Hail Mary.
Yeah.
He will die if we don't do it. He'll probably die during the operation if we do it. And if he does survive, he's going to just be a vegetable. And I go, is there any precedent to where this ever worked? And they said, yes, but we don't even want to mention it because it's so ridiculously small that he'll even have a life after this. We walked back in and there's a chance. And so we took it. And we gave them the green light. And within 2 minutes, they were wheeling them down the hallway to the operating room. And they did the ECMO, and they came out an hour and a half later and said it was a success. He didn't die. And now it's a waiting game. So long story short, 2 months later, he's finally off ECMO. Two more times in there, he died again because of the...
In the 2 months that followed. So this moment that you just went through happened a couple more times. It's not like this is... You had to do that with Rosemary like three times total.
Yeah, we were we were there for two of them. And then another time happened it when we weren't in the room where they had to resuscitate him. And so it just kept happening. And then he'd get out of septic shock and his bone marrow started working again and his liver started. I mean, he blew up like the Michelin Man. He was so his whole body was swollen. Like they had papers all over telling the nurses to be gentle, not to touch him very hard when they bathed because his skin would rupture.
Right.
Because he was so swollen. I mean, it was horrific. And we managed people who would come visit because the scene was very
graphic.
Hard, hard to see him, you know, and his skull's dented in and half gone. And so it was rough. It was very traumatic. But so he's in a coma for over 2 months. He's in imposed paralysis, so they made sure he stayed paralyzed so that he couldn't damage other things. He was on that ECMO and respirator, and they kept him in a coma for nearly 3 months. And then he just makes a miracle. But really, I mean, I don't know if you believe in miracles or who does or doesn't, but the doctors are just like, we don't understand, but he's coming out of it. And they allow him to wake up. They put the skull back in. He still looks pretty brutal. By this time, he's gone from 185 pounds to 118 pounds.
Wow.
His lowest point was probably 109 and zero muscle. He was just a bag of bones sitting on that bed. And he wakes up and he can only just move his right hand barely. No other movement in his body. So we thought, and he only had one eye that worked. And then slowly but surely, he just kept getting more and more and more and more. All the way to where they released him 3 months after the accident to a mental rehab facility up at the University of Utah. And long story short, that Yahoo was released 4 months after the accident, and I built a whole new suite into my home that was ADA accessible and put in a chairlift. The kid didn't even use it. He walked up the stairs on his own, and he's never used any of the grab bars. A week after he got home, he ran his own 5K that we held in honor of him for a fundraiser. And I mean, it was scary watching him run because he couldn't run very well. But he's so determined to where now we are, 7-8 months later, and he has been cleared to drive. He's back working with his brothers, light duty, but it's getting better every day. And while he's still got a long road to go mentally, physically, he's 100% back. And it's just a real miracle.
God is good. That there is no other word for it. That is a miracle. How is he, like, I want to ask, like, how is he doing today? You mentioned so still a long road. Like, where is he at cognitively, emotionally, personality wise? Can you talk about some of that stuff?
Yeah. So he's certainly a different person. Of course he is. His brain was altered, and the brain is the seat of the personality, right? So his personality, while it's still James, it's different James. He's still got some higher function because he damaged the front prefrontal cortex, where the higher function decision making and nuance and things like that, the left temporal lobe is a lot of memory. He has some memory issues, short-term memory, and all those things are getting better. But like the neurosurgeon warned us, listen, this takes time. Like give him the benefit of time to recover and to brain plasticity to make new neural pathways. He deals with depression. It's, you can only imagine waking up being a completely different person, where you used to be who everybody depended on. Now you depend on everybody. The relationships he had, you know, his fiance, they're no longer together because he is a different person. And so there's a lot of challenges, and he wrestles with a lot of depression and the realization that things are different for him. And he's got a long struggle and a hard struggle to get back to what he wants to be.
Does he talk about the event? Does he have, you know, does he have memory of it? Does he, I'm so curious, was there any part of it that he was there for? Straight to black, woke up months later? Like, does he have any recollection of that night or the months that followed?
Nothing. Like, even after he woke from a coma, it was probably, his earliest memory is probably 3 weeks after he came out of a coma. And even that's kind of spotty. And then the night of, he doesn't remember anything until maybe a day before the accident happened. So he's lost all of that. And he didn't have a near-death experience or anything. He doesn't remember anything during a coma, just during his rehab.
That's a seriously tough kid you got there, Brady.
Yeah, he's a beast.
How has this impacted you? Like has this taught, I mean, it must have taught you something about life. Any big insights or wisdoms or lessons from this journey you've been on the last 7 months?
Yeah, a lot. A lot of life lessons, but also business lessons. So
let's talk about
the life lessons first. It really made me take stock in what's most important. You know, and we hear these things talk about a lot, and sometimes we actually will sit down on a Sunday morning over coffee and go, oh, what's important? What am I grateful for in life? Right. When I was faced with a chronic, like perpetual for 3 or 4 months in a row of my son almost dying and making decisions that no parent should ever have to make, it really cut through all the bull in my life. Like, what really is important and what's actually just petty and doesn't really mean anything. Like, all of my possessions, all of my vacations, all my whatever, it's just petty. You know, really almost everything is petty. Almost everything that we have in life, every little squabble, every little conflict, every little disagreement, the things that we really want, that new car, that whatever, that's, while some of those maybe you do need to deal with, they're not what's most important. What's most important is like family, your personal integrity, beauty, you know, these deep-seated soulful things. That's what's important. Your relationships, you know, and it just put it in such stark reality for me. And the gratitude that to see people who barely knew me just pour out love and concern. You know, frankly, the BTA community were amazing. You know, all they knew me was from a business perspective. I mean, some of them knew me a little better than that, but
not really. Yeah.
Not a lot, but they really rallied around me, and family, like petty squabbles and things like that. I saw healing take place over James's bed between siblings and parents that might have had squabbles and realized none of that's important. Why in the world am I holding on to that, right? Mm-hmm. So the life lesson is gratitude. And there's so many petty things in life and things in life that really aren't important. And almost all of them are that.
There's we waste a lot of time and bandwidth, man. This species it's pretty mind-boggling. And it's really a shame that we need to have these like unbelievably traumatic, awful, sad things happen to put it into perspective. But when you say that, it strikes me how many minutes of the day are wasted on what's at the very, very trivial.
Yeah. I didn't get chocolate ice cream, man. We got vanilla, you know, and it ruins our day. Or, you know, I had a squabble with my brother, you know. Yeah. Can you imagine? Or I remember when my wife said this to me and it hurt my feelings. You know, all of those things are just so trivial, and why we sit there and hold on to them. So being in this pressure cooker just made all that so real to me. And I've determined to hold on to that and to really excavate all that out of my life and only concentrate on the good things.
I got to ask, and this is not the point of the conversation. The point of the conversation is the story of what happened to James and you and family. And I really want, especially our BTA, you know, this is really for like the BTA crew. We have a lot of non-BTA listeners, but I do want the whole BTA universe to kind of know about this story because it's so unbelievable. And so that's really the point of this. But you mentioned like some business lessons. Like, I got to ask, like, you run a big organization there at Ox Glass. Like, what the hell happened to it over the last 7 months?
Yeah. So we had been working really hard with BTA, getting systems and people and processes in place. And we can talk about what some of those things are that we did later if you want. But and I had gotten pretty well there. Right. I mean, I was in Master Circle. I had fully integrated everything I wanted to integrate before this happened. You know, we had tripled the size of my company in just a few years and had a great net profit and good people in place, all my GSRs being held. And then this happens. Right. And it wasn't like Mike McAllowitz says, you know, you plan a month away and you get everything in place and then you extract yourself from the company. I didn't have any time to warn everybody, hey, I'm going to be unavailable for a month. I was ripped from the company, you know, and overnight, like I was completely unavailable for 5 weeks. I had one phone call with Jared like 3 days after. And he came to the hospital to see my son and stood by the bed and he says, Brady, don't worry about anything. We got it. And also my business admin guy, who was also a good friend of James, came by and they just says, you just be here. You take whatever you need. We got it. We got Ox. And I wasn't even thinking, I didn't care. I didn't care if my company went. All I thought about was my son sitting there dying in the hospital. Well, when I was torn out, sure, you put in systems, you put in protocols, you hire good people. But when you're torn out of the company, there's no stopgap. Everywhere my finger was in the dam holding a plug became very, very apparent. Mm. Like the leaks sprung and they became really, really easy to see. Mm. Like where I was still fishing in the production department and answering this question when really it was probably my department head, my head of production. You know, I was still handling this in sales. I was still answering that question or doing this thing, going to that meeting that I shouldn't have been. Well, I wasn't there to do any of it. And so all of the questions, all of the issues where I was doing stuff I shouldn't have been doing became very apparent. And then everything I should be doing just wasn't being done. So who's going to do that? Right. And so I'm really proud to say that when I came back, I started 6 weeks later. I came back in. Well, it was actually 3 months later. 3 months later, I came back into the office 6 weeks later. I stepped back in the office for the first time and just got an update. Hey, how's everything going? You know, do we still have a company? And my brother, Jared, just says, pardon my French, what the f*** are you doing? Mm. And I go, I'm just here to make sure everything's going okay. And he says, you get back to the hospital with your boy. We got this. And he didn't go into any of the details of the problems that had gone wrong and what they had found. They just went to work. And I'm really proud of them because we had really good people, number one, in place. Number two, really good systems. And those people felt empowered to make decisions without me. And they did. They created complete new systems that became very obvious that there was a flaw in our company. When I actually came back to work 3.5 months later, I came back to a stronger company than when I left.
That cannot be what you were expecting.
Were you prepared to walk into
a dumpster fire, total train wreck? Maybe it's gone bankrupt. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought the sales were going to be like way diminished. Like we didn't follow through on lead. No, everything was better. Like the production department was running better than when I left it. The pre-production department had new systems in place and new protocols to make sure that the follow-up, because I was just following up on estimates and stuff like that, that should have been followed up. Now nobody was. And so who are they calling? Well, they're defaulting to whoever they can find. And so we put new follow-up protocols in the pre-production department, the sales department. And my daughter, Carly, stepped up the game on being our project coordinator and way better scheduling protocols for all the crews and ordering of materials. So all of these things where I was just kind of being defaulted to just were taken care of. So I was so proud of that. And frankly, we'll go from probably to $27 million in revenue this year after it's in the pipeline. And we are only $20 million in the pipeline that we were forecasted to make last year.
It seems insane to me. Is there anything that you've reflected on in hindsight where you look back and you go, and like, maybe try to answer this just in terms of like first principles thinking, not necessarily, hey, I was super fortunate because I had this individual person, but is there anything in that you guys did well that allowed for this? Like specific systems, specific technology, specific ways of doing things where you go, hey, you know what? That's the reason, or that's part of the reason I came back to overall a pretty healthy entity.
Yeah, I think it just started right off the bat with a very, very well-developed org structure, like an org chart where specific roles and responsibilities and who they answer to. And it went from the CEO, me, all the way down, you know, and divided up in departments and then who's in charge of those and all the way down to warehouse tech. And everybody knew their place and their responsibilities. I didn't need to be there to respond, to remind them, you know, they're holding their GSRs with their foreman or their department head, you know, and then my leadership team was in place, which is each department head plus culture committee and, you know, a few people like that. So my leadership team was in place with two clear people in my brother, who's just a stabilizing force. Everybody sees him. He's been with me for 30 years in three different companies, defaulted to him a ton. Mm. And then my office coordinator, who he's over all of the office, but he's also relied upon for interdepartmental communication. Mm. And everybody knew it. He's what makes everybody communicate really well. And then we had the systems within that org chart, you know, a really great system of accounting in holding GSRs regularly. Really great trackers that track KPIs. Like, I'm a big numbers guy. Like, if you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. And so we have real-time tracking that I want. It's summarized in a KPI sheet, and each department has theirs. And then I have a summary all the way up to my leadership team and then me, tracking everything from, you know, in the pre-production department, like sales ratios and hit and miss, and all the way down to like what our which job our competition got. So we track all of that information. So they had all the information. It didn't just reside within me or on my computer. Like, all of those key performance indicators were shared throughout as they're relevant to every person. Mm-hmm. So communication was huge and key between the developer org structure. And then some really, really good spreadsheets and tech, you know, our estimating software. So we had a really good tech stack to keep the company going within each department as they're relevant, right? Bookkeeping them.
So these things all played a role in like leaving behind some infrastructure when you're ripped away to allow people to know what to do in your absence. But I mean, there must be some kind of secret sauce here in terms of your team culture. I mean, all the systems in the world isn't going to make somebody stick around. Like, it sounds like people understood what happened, the gravity of it. And rallied around that and stuck around. Like, do you have any? Have you thought about what's going on the cultural level that facilitated that?
Yeah, for sure. Like, your core values are what generate your culture, right? And you got to be really clear on what your core values are as a business owner, and then export that to the company and get buy-in. And I think, you know, Our core values are fire, family, integrity, relentless, and efficient. And the family part in an event like this was everything. Like, I mean, you could see that they really felt a family tie to not me, but James and each other. They rallied around each other. They'd get together on the weekends. You know, they did, you know, fundraising events for him. They went over and the company went over and cleaned his house. And, you know, I mean, they rallied around his fiance, you know, I mean, and his mother. Like, there was so much outpouring from people within our company to me and Rosemary. Sorry. So that was so heartwarming to see that it wasn't just a business. It really was a family, and we pride ourselves on being a family run and oriented company. Mm-hmm. Like, our employees come first, and our clients come second. And you know, and we know that if we take care of our employees like that, they're going to take care of the clients as if they came first. So, and I think that was really evident. I think that is the secret sauce that rallied them through to where they didn't just like, oh, whatever, you know, oh, you know, that's bad, but whatever, I got to make money. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the attitude. Mm-hmm. It was all hands on deck for months and months.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty humbling, so, man. I mean, like, a lot of people say this, the core values, and we have a good culture, and this gets talked about to the nth degree out there in the business universe today, on podcasts and on YouTube and at keynote speeches, yeah. Right? But I mean, it's easy to make it sound easy when the rubber really meets the road is in a situation like yours, where it's truly that culture is truly reality tested. And I mean, I just think it must be such an honor for you and humbling for you to watch that happen with your team automatically.
Yeah. It's not like anybody needed to remind them to. Mm-hmm. And any more than anybody would need to remind you to go, if your brother was in an accident, to go take care of him, right? And I will say also, our brand, our culture is recognized by the general contractors that we and developers that we do business with, because I had more than one vice president of production from a huge multi-billion dollar company just stop by the hospital and just say, how's things going? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it was amazing to see. And it's because they know the quality of the relationship that we have. And that relationship was all built on those shared values that they have. Mm-hmm. And they recognize it in us. And I was one of those that was just like, oh yeah, what's this core value thing BTA keeps on talking about, you know, and culture. And like, oh, it's about the numbers. It's about working hard and getting done. No, it really does start with that. And people can recognize it. And people want to do business with quality people, all things being equal, you know, and that's how you that's how you communicate it.
I want to ask you, this is, I'm kind of switching gears here, but you know, we talked offline last week about Josh. And I think that there's kind of like a lesson here for other BTAers about so maybe just, this is a bit of a departure, but I think it is connected to what we're talking about. Talk about Josh. Who is this kid? How'd you find him? What's he done for the business? I think that there's a real kind of implementation hack here for some of our listeners, if you can lay it out for us.
Yeah, for BTA or non-BTA people, you know, you need to implement systems within your business, right? And that's BTA's sole secret sauce is implementation of systems and people. Well, I'm struggling. I'm floundering in BTA in the first 6 months or a year. And Dan Steph can attest, you know, I'm doing a pissant job at it and really going slow because I'm trying to run everything and then implement what James Dale's face on the computer is telling me to do.
Yeah.
And so I just identify this kid who really wasn't a very good installer, but he came to work for me in a summer and he washed out as an installer.
You hired him to be an installer originally. This was like a summer job for him or something?
A summer job. Yeah, he was going to school in business admin. And I says, listen, when you graduate, give me a call. Because I could see, so one of Brady's business philosophies on hiring is hire for potential and fit. Mm-hmm. Like, how does he fit my culture? Does he share my core values? And his potential, his business acumen, or his, if he's an installer, his installer acumen. Well, he had that in spades when it come to business savvy, and his cultural fit was perfect. He was like a son to me. And so he graduates a year later. I hire the kid to just come into the office and start doing all of my accounts payable. And a lot of the receivables. Well, it's that time that I'm struggling to implement anything, and I'm just working 60 hours a week, and it's just ridiculous, right? And 60, 70 hours a week. And I just make a decision. Listen, I'm going to hire another bookkeeper, and I want 20 hours of your work week to do nothing but sit right alongside me and implement. And you know, what does that mean? And I got Stav's permission, and he was on every BTA call with me, and he went down into it. He was learning the entire BTA system with me and implementing with me for half of his time. And I dedicated 20 hours a week of my time. I hired two other people in the production and pre-production department to fill up 20 hours worth each. So 40 hours worth of my 20 hours to fill the holes that I was vacating in that. And I dedicated 20 hours a week to implement. And we just skyrocketed. I mean, we just took off with him. Now, I think he's special in that he's also young and didn't have any preconceived ideas.
Okay, but people try this all the time, Brady. They're like, people try this, I'm going to hire this person and they're going to implement with me. And 98 times out of 100, it totally flops. And I think it's because they hire the wrong person or the leader, the owner, like in this situation, you, is not communicating or explaining or describing the outcomes they want clearly enough. There's something that happens some kind of breakdown that happened. So I'm wondering if you can think of like why this worked with Josh, because he has a young guy who was frankly a installer in your business, who has added, you know, millions of dollars of business value over a few years by just getting him to focus on implementation stuff. I mean, why did it work in this situation and versus it failing with so many others?
So I think it's twofold. I think I can take credit for a little bit of it in that, and where I see it fail with other people is the owner is too much. Listen, most business owners have a high ego and they're really driven and they've made all the decisions and rarely been challenged. And so it's hard for them to be challenged. So they don't even make an opportunity to be challenged. And I recognized that in myself. And I says, listen, Josh, this is going to be hard for you. You're a 24-year-old kid. I'm a 51-year-old business owner that's been doing it for 30 years on my own. I'm telling you, even if I'm standing up to you and saying you're wrong, you're part of your job is to stand up to me and is to challenge me, is to look for holes in the way I'm thinking and doing things, identify problems in the company and come to me and then stand your ground. I mean, ultimately, I get to have my way, but your job is to challenge my way.
Right.
And he took that seriously, and it was difficult for him in the beginning.
That's a pretty big ask for a young guy.
Yeah, but he did it, right? And I knew he had that chutzpah. And then he's also, I'm not a detail guy. Like, if you did our personality tests, I'm a big idea guy. I'm a high-energy guy. I'm really charismatic and go any closed deals. But I'll give him the idea, and now you take care of the details. And he loves it. He is a detail guy. He sees systems and knows how to just make them mesh and work and communicate with each other in a way that I can't do. And so he was the yin to my yang. Mm-hmm. And it just really, really worked, mm-hmm. You know, and he fast quickly was out of all accounting, running the entire office department. And now he's office admin and doing other big things in my company. So he's like 2A in my company.
Is so now he's just like full-time on implementation?
No, now he spends maybe 5 or 10 hours a week on implementation because we've done a lot of implementing.
Yeah.
And so we refine the things that we've implemented. Occasionally we'll implement new systems, but not a lot. That growth curve, now he's stabilizing and in charge of communicating.
So if someone's listening to this and they go, that's kind of a cool idea, I would love to have my version of a Josh who can do some of the implementation work for me, because I'm also highly visionary. I'm not great on details. I see the big picture. Like, you know the story. Mm-hmm. Is there any advice that you would give to an entrepreneur to, like, find a Josh?
You do what I did. Look for a kid fresh out of college, really good acumen. If you're a business owner, you're probably a big idea, visionary guy. And don't like to be messed with the details. Find someone who's real detail oriented, mm-hmm. really strong in math and systems and stuff like that. And also someone who's got enough character to stand up to you, mm-hmm. and then be willing to shut your mouth and listen, mm-hmm. which that's probably going to be your biggest problem is you. It always is, right? Your biggest problem is always you. So realize that.
Let me ask you a couple of just like high level, like your philosophy on things. I mean, you guys mm-hmm. run a big shop there. You've been doing this a long time. You're a very admired entrepreneur in the Breakthrough Academy universe. Let me just ask you a few things. Like, what is the Brady Williams like approach to hiring and team building?
I kind of mentioned it. I hire for potential mm-hmm. and fit. So cultural fit, does he have the same or she have the same core values? And then potential for whatever role I'm hiring for. Like, they don't have to have that much experience. I mean, sometimes they will. And we've hired some good people with a lot of experience in the field. But the most important thing for sure is potential and then fit. And core values is everything, because they're going to represent your brand out in the world. So they better have that as part of their soul.
Experience is overrated?
I think so. I know there's different mode of thought there. That's not the way I've been.
Yeah.
Because you can teach, and I want to teach people my way anyway, because our way of doing it has proven to be really well.
What is your philosophy on getting people to think independently and solve problems for themselves?
When they make mistakes, well, first you give them the power to go out and make a mistake, right? And so you're delegating responsibility. Well, first, you got to get it out of you. If you're doing too much work, and you are, if you're a business owner, you're always doing too much day to day. Give them the power. And then when they make a mistake, you can't discipline them for that mistake. You have to empower them through it and make it an opportunity, not something to be chastised, because you'll just ruin them. You'll just deflate, and then they'll never want to make a decision again. And so I really think that that's the best way. You have to give them power and then not neuter their power by coming down on them for a mistake. And that's so easy to do.
I mean, I was going to say that takes some discipline. Like, do you have any thoughts on how to keep, like, I suck at this. I often will kind of breathe down people's necks or come down hard on people. I ask them to go and take a risk. They take a risk. They get it wrong. And then I'm there like blowing them up 10 minutes later. It's really not a good look for me. Any advice on just having the discipline to allow them to be in that kind of exploratory garden, make their own mistakes, but still support them?
Yeah, I mean, you got to navel gaze and look at yourself. When do you operate the best? When do you make the most gains? It's when you've made a mistake. Because if you've never made a mistake, that means you're not growing, mm-hmm. right? You're just doing it the same old way. So anytime you've ever grown, you've identified a mistake and changed it. So you should be celebrating when you make a mistake, because there's an opportunity to learn. Mm-hmm. And if you just remind yourself and really make sure that that's the way you're going to approach every mistake. Like, I've had estimators make $180,000 mistakes. I'm just like, whoa, okay. What's the learning opportunity here, Mike? And we go back to the table. We identify, was it a systematic failure? Was it just human error? Where was the error? And then what are we going to do from here? And then also another, so that's in mistakes, but to get them to act independent, like say I go to a project manager and I give him this responsibility. He's a new fledgling project manager, and he'll always want to go back and double check his decision before he makes his decision. Never make the decision for him. Just push it back, asking a question. Well, what would you do? Well, I would do this. And I says, yeah, go do that.
Yeah.
And then just keep pushing. And then if they keep going, just say, listen, I don't want you to come ask me anymore. You got this. You can do it. Like, I'm not going to answer your question. And I had one guy, no, you need to answer this question. And he says, I'm not going to. Mm. Like, this is why I hired you. I didn't hire you to come ask me to make all your decisions.
Yeah.
And so you have to keep pushing back and challenging them to make their own decisions. So sometimes they have to be reminded about that.
What do you, how do you approach like developing and nurturing talent? Because you mentioned you're kind of all about fit, you're all about culture, and I think there's a real desire for many, many BTA members and listeners to, I think the term is like to home grow their talent. It's like you, mm-hmm. you move people up the org chart. Josh is a good example. I'm sure you have others. Yeah. How do you do that well?
I think there needs to be opportunity, and I think that opportunity needs to be, and I could do a better job at this, of communicating the opportunities and the vision of the company. And then people will naturally want to grow and develop if they're on my team, because that's part of fit, is they have a growth mindset. So they want to improve themselves and they want to improve the company. And so those type of people are always looking for opportunities to improve. And then, so I need to make sure the company and the vision is communicated to them to where they will challenge themselves, like continuing education. Like, I'll pay for any type of education. Like, you want to learn this new system or Google Doc or whatever and go get certification. I'm on board. You want to go to Florida and do this training for a better window install, let's do it, you know? So there's a lot of different ways you can support their growth. Mm. and develop them as a person. But not just that, like I'll pay for therapy if they are depressed and having tough times at home. You know, when you have those meetings where you're just in touch with them as a human, not just as an employee, mm-hmm. all of that just creates an environment for growth.
Do you let the team know that and then allow them to come to you with the course, with the program, with the thing that they think they want? Or do you dictate to them what you want them to be educated on?
It's probably a little of both. Like I'll find things and I'll say, hey, I think it'd be really important for your department, your pre-production department to go learn this and can go look for some kind of course.
Right.
Know? Like here's a good example. AI in estimating.
Right.
We want to be cutting edge in our field. And so he went out and found Toggle AI.
Yeah.
And so he's test running that right now.
I've done a demo.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
So there's so many different things out there. And I just push and I says, let's be cutting edge. Let's be top of the field. You know, new different kind of products down at the builder show in Vegas, you know? So these types of things were constant and I'll purposely, I could just go do it and find it, but I'll push them to go do it and find it. And they love that. You know, they love going out and doing stuff like that. So,
we're almost out of time here, but I want to ask you just like a final closing question on this, which is this. I mean, you've been through just an insane journey here over the last 7-8 months. And this happens in life. Heavy stuff sort of makes its way for reasons we don't understand into our lives from time to time. I wonder if you have any advice, any perspective, any wisdom you can impart on a potential listener right now, running a business like yours, who is also going through some insanely heavy stuff in their personal life.
Well, hopefully you have, it starts with you first, right? And you've got to be resilient and strong enough and take time enough to understand you. And these things translate not just to the big items, but to the small items of how good of a boss or an employer or anything like that you are. But get really clear on you and then really rely on the ones you love, the communities, you know, in concentric rings. Like there's the community of you and then your family, you know, those who you're most intimate with, your spouse, your children, your brothers, sisters, but then out and out and out in concentric rings and make sure all of those are really healthy. And if they're not healthy, fine. Find the one, if you're going through something like that, lean on them, depend on them. And then don't sweat the small stuff, all that petty shit that how we opened it up with, right? The petty is just, I don't know, maybe that was before we started talking on air, but the petty things are so stupid and it's almost all petty stuff that we have in life. Just shed those off, get real about what's really important to you and hold on to that. And I, you know, hopefully you'll make it through.
I really want to give you a sincere thank you for sharing this story with us, Brady. We spent a lot of time on this podcast talking about, you know, systems and tactics and growth and how to make your business better. And I am trying to make more of an attempt to bring on kind of the human side of this. These are human-driven businesses with men and women and families and kids and aging parents and sicknesses and all sorts of stuff that happens. And I really, really appreciate you kind of opening up about this unbelievable thing that your family's been through. It was harrowing to watch from our perspective, getting the updates about James throughout the summer and the fall and into the winter. And it was just really a beautiful, an amazing miracle to get that photo at the end of him walking out of the hospital. So thanks for your time today, dude. Can't wait to see you again when that happens.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our channel, consider sharing this episode with another contractor who you think needs to hear it.